Welcome to our presentation about parsing and manipulating binary data in Dylan. My name is Andreas Bog. Co-developer and co-speaker is Hannes Müller. I think this is an audience which is most likely to already have heard about Dylan. It's not a very popular language, but a very nice one in some aspects. It started out in the early 90s as, in one way, an attempt to bring Lisp features to the masses, and another way is as an attempt to take all the crap in common Lisp and clean it up for good. There were some major Lisp people involved in it. The at the Cambridge Laboratories, Carnegie Mellon University, and Harlequin, all big Lisp names. And unfortunately, Java got the mind share. Good thing is, these days you don't have to talk to people anymore that garbage collection is actually useful, something you want to have. But bad thing is, still don't have all the cool features in modern language that you want to have. Okay, for those of you who don't have any Dylan experience, here's a short rundown in comparison to mostly common Lisp. It has been designed with performance in mind, which means you don't get eval, which also means that you can turn off dynamic features, like for instance ceiling of different scopes of generic functions and ceiling of classes, promise not to inherit at runtime, etc. It's got a little bit cleaned up and better module and library management, which separates a namespace versus a unit of compilation. It's got a Algol 60-like syntax, which is, I think, the thing that sets it apart from all the other Lisp dialects. Started out having an S-expression syntax in the interim reference manual, but eventually somebody decided that it would be better if it had a syntax more familiar to the average user. The jury is still out whether it was a good idea or not. I hope we can contribute some parts to this discussion today. The feature that most people actually like about the syntax is the non-indenting let. So that's a big one. Okay, Dylan macros. Dylan macros work by doing pattern matching and substitution, basically on the parse tree. So what you see here is a comparison between a macro as it would have been written in Lisp and the same macro in Dylan. In a Lisp macro, what you have on the right-hand side is a Lisp expression that evaluates eventually to a Lisp, which is the representation of a parse tree in Lisp. And in Dylan, you have a left-hand side, which is the second line of that definition, and then an arrow on the right-hand side. What it does is a pattern matching on the left-hand side, and substituting that on the right-hand, substituting that on the right-hand side with the interpolated variables. So the question mark in the Dylan macro introduces a macro variable. There's a colon. That part after the colon is the type. And the type is basically part of the defined Dylan syntax. So you can have expression there, body there, and there's a fragment grammar that describes what a body could look like, what an expression can look like. And in the simplest case, this is just taken and replaced in the substitution, and the substitution is inserted there. So if you want, you can do a rough translation between Lisp macros and Dylan macros. If you say that there's a backquoted list on the right-hand side, and then it corresponds almost one-to-one. The Dylan macros do have a slightly better destructuring mechanism. So you can do more interesting or powerful things with keywords, etc., etc., without having to resort to actually executing code to have conditional statements. We will see more modern macros later, and we'll go into some more aspects when watching actual code. So, what do we want to do? It's a problem every programmer has, that binary data is ubiquitous. You find it everywhere. It's the stuff people transmit to you on the network. It's those bags of bytes you find on your disk, especially if you have one of those operating systems written in C, where bags of bytes seems to be the predominant data structure. And most of it is not formally specified. So there are some subdomains which are like you have ASN1 and a lot of telco protocols, and you have stuff like CORBA, etc. But if you look at TCP/IP, for instance, it's all RFCs, and they have that little ASCII art, and that's the common specification of it, so that's not very much. And it's certainly not enough to automatically generate a parser and a generator for that formats from it. So that's what we set out to do. We wanted to be able to describe a binary data structure so that it would allow us to both analyze it, read out the structure of it, and also generate it. So if you have a high-level description, take that and translate it into a binary data vector, which you can then send out on the network, etc., etc. We actually had a pretty big motivation for doing that, and that's that there is a very popular tool for doing network analysis, which is called Wireshark, used to be called Ethereal, and which knows lots and lots and lots of protocols. But if you look at the source code for that, it's really awful. I actually did a count, and I found 41 different places that know about the precise length and structure of a certain field in a header. Not one, 41. And this, of course, also means that there are lots of bugs in Ethereal. And as it is, file format parsing seems to be so hard that people write remotely exploitable software with it. And Wireshark is actually the leading software when it comes to count of vulnerabilities of exploitable problems in the source code. It's running into more than 100 CVE entries. And so on one hand, it's the tool you have to use if you do any kind of network security, network analysis. On the other hand, it's the tool that's most likely to go vulnerable against attacks. And that basically was our motivation to get it started. But of course, when we started it, we also wanted to be universally usable. So if we did it, we thought we would do it right. So these were the goals we had. It should be expressive. I don't want to write something 41 times. Once is enough. And it should support encapsulation. I do not want to think about whether I'm on a big endian or little endian computer system. I don't care. I want to say what the packet looks like, and the framework and the language, and the compiler should do the rest for me. It should be as generic as possible. It should be applicable to all the binary data you would find somewhere. And that's the biggest problem for stuff like that. It should be efficient. It's if you want to use it to write network applications, you want to be able to run it at gigabit speeds. And yeah, we'll see how far we got in all those four aspects. So if you look at those bags of bytes, you will notice that they are basically recursively defined. You have some byte vectors which have no further structure, like, for instance, a MAC address or an IP address or a 2-byte big endian unsigned integer. It's we call that a leaf frame. It's a fundamental structure. And then you have what we call a container frame, which consists of a number of fields, where each field in turn has a frame type. Like you have a Ethernet frame, which is an Ethernet header, and that Ethernet header has a source address as its field, and that source address in turn is a MAC address. So you end up with a recursive structure which pretty much describes any performance out there. And then the stuff in the container frame, the fields, they essentially have a name. So we can talk about the source address of an Ethernet frame. And they usually have a frame type. So we know that the source address is a MAC address. It can get pretty complex from there on because, for instance, the payload of an Ethernet frame doesn't have a fixed type. It has a type that changes depending on the value of other fields. So we have to find a way to annotate that. And you have lots of meta information that goes in there. So you have start and end offsets of fields which are not always fixed, which sometimes depend on the values of other fields and values of padding, etc., etc. And all this is information that needs to be annotated in the field. Okay, with that, I hand over to Hannes to show an example of a definition.
That's our incomplete example of an Ethernet frame. So we developed this domain-specific language, the defined protocol syntax. So you can, with the DOM macros, you add basically rules to the grammar of the DOM and have definition macros. So defined protocol is handled by our macro. So we define here a protocol Ethernet frame, which super protocol or super class is a header frame. Header frame is our abstract class which defines a container frame which contains a payload. So something like an Ethernet frame which has a header and a payload, and something like an IP frame which has a header and a payload. So the first field is the destination address. It's a MAC address, so we can simply write it down. That is first the name of the field and then the type. The same with source address. Due to the type MAC address, the system or our system knows that the MAC address is 6 bytes long and can define specific getters and setters for that field. Then comes a field type code, which is a 2-byte big endian unsigned integer, which is on high level, so in our actual code an integer. But we needed a way to preserve the encoding information of a field, because once you want to put in 42 into that field, it has to be encoded into 2 bytes. Then the last field is a variably typed field. A variably typed field is something that is that has no constant type at compile time, but it depends on the actual byte vector which is there at runtime. So you have to provide a type function. The type function is a simple DOM expression, which gets an unhygienic binding in the macro. So you get a binding to the frame object. So you can select on frame.typecode, which is a getter on the type code of the frame, of the actual frame. And if it's #x800, we return IPv4 frame as type. If it's 806, we return upframe, and the default case is simply a raw frame. Yet, this is what we can do with that code. So we have basically we have basically two ways how a packet can be generated or passed. The first is if we receive a byte vector, we can call pass frame on that byte vector. So we can call pass frame, Ethernet frame, on a specific byte vector and get a frame object returned, which is not yet passed. It is simply associates an Ethernet frame with a byte vector. And once we access one of these slots, one of the source address, destination address, type code, it actually passes that. So what you can do is print out the source address, for example. That's done in the first example. So that code does pass the source address, which our parser looks up. While source address is at byte offset 6 and is 6 bytes long, so pass byte 6 to 12 and transform it to a MAC address and generate the high-level MAC address object and print it out. On the other hand, we can do manipulation of data. So we can set the destination address of the frame to some MAC address. For example, the MAC address of 00.8.00. This does two things. On the one hand, it sets the high-level MAC address objects in the Ethernet frame. On the other hand, it replaces the byte vector to correspond to that MAC address. So it replaces bytes 0 to 6 in the actual byte vector to correspond to the chain. So we have the feature of in-place reassembly. So once we have an unpassed frame or a frame associated with the byte vector, we we have a setup which edits also the byte vector as well as the high level object. And the last example down here is generating an Ethernet frame on the high level. So we don't have a byte vector, but we want to send out a packet, for example. That can be done with make Ethernet frame source address, some MAC address. MAC address is a function that receives the string and returns a MAC address. Destination address, some other MAC address. Type code, some type code, not yet specified. And the payload is simply our frame from before, so we can return back the frame. And on that high-level frame, we can say assemble frame. We can call assemble frame of that frame and get the actual byte vector rate. So our design goals were parsing, manipulating, and assembling frames, and doing stuff as lazy as we can in the parsing case, because in the normal case, you are not interested in most of the packets you receive. You're only interested in those who you want to access and who have the destination address to you. Okay, on the next slide, I will show the macro system we use. That's the protocol defined macro. That's a top level macro we use. So in Boeing, you define the macro with define macro, then the define a macro, then the left hand side and the right hand side. So we define here a macro with define some attributes. Some attributes, which is a star which matches anything, then protocol, then a name, and super protocol, which is also a name, and then a list of fields that's anything, and then the keyword and. This expands to several macros. Real class definer is a macro which does the real class definitions. It gets the attributes, the name. The name is spliced with angle brackets, because class definitions by convention in Dom are prepended and appended by angle brackets. And hash mark in Dom macros is the splicing operator. So you have an angle bracket, then the name, then the closing angle bracket. The same is supercritical, and it also receives the fields. Fields is the list of fields. It's anything between the defined protocol and the end. Then decoded class definer. Decoded class definer is our high-level object which has no binary, no byte vector associated with it. So we call it in every protocol definition decoded Ethernet frame or decoded protocol, just as the name is. And it receives as superclasses the name as well as the super protocol prepended by decoded. Yeah, then get classes which generates some convenience functions to transform from one of those classes to another, so from unpassed to decoded and from Ethernet frame to decoded Ethernet frame and so on. Then frame view generator is our macro which generates the lazy parser, the getters for the lazy parser, as well as the in-place reassembly setters. Frame view generator gets the fields, the class it has to provide the getters and setters with, that's unpassed Ethernet frame or unpassed anything, and a field count. Field count is the number of fields of the super protocol, because we need an index.
Yeah, that's actually an efficiency hack. So instead of walking some list, we keep count of the field number and then have a vector with the field objects in it to get at the field object without having to do much work just by index.
Yeah, then another macro container frame constructor. Yet just generate some convenience functions to create container frames. So create an Ethernet frame. That one is a decoded class definer. As I said, decoded class definer generates the high level object. So it does a define class of the name. So define class decoded Ethernet frame in our Ethernet frame example. Then the superclasses, the fields, and end. Fields is here somewhat special because fields is an auxiliary macro. So you have, in the dual macro system, you have top-level macros, and you can have a number of auxiliary macros. Auxiliary macros are defined as below the fields, and you have as well the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and can do pattern matching, so an empty field resource to empty. And a field which matches anything, a colon and three dots. Three dots are for recursion, so it matches the same auxiliary macro. Expands to the field, which is in this case once again an auxiliary macro. Colon and three dots. So we generate those slots in the field auxiliary macro and use the recursion in the field auxiliary macro. The field auxiliary macro now has two left-hand sides. That's a variably typed field, as you have seen, and a field of a specific name and a specific type and some rest. Both generate a slot with the match name of a type which is false or frame, or false or high-level type or field type. This high-level type is a function of a class which translates the 2-byte big endian unsigned integer to an integer, to a limited integer. Because on the high level, we don't want to mess around with those types which are integers. So we don't want to mess around with encoding, but we only need the information that it's an integer which is between 0 and 2 to the power of 16 minus 1. Yet also generates an inner keyword of the given name where question mark, hash mark, and apostrophes are the symbol syntax of the matched token. So that name here is actually then a symbol and will be converted to a symbol from the matched name. So source address, which is just a token, and will get converted to the symbol source address. Yet DOM slots are quite equal, but not the same as CompilED. So they have some syntactic sugar in it. They have, for example, the init keyword, and they have a type specific. They can have a type specification with the two double colons. With the two. Okay. The next macro I will show is a frame view generator. The frame view generator's job is to generate the getters and setters, or to let the getters and setters be generated. So we once again use recursion here in this macro, but this time we do it by hand because we want to count the number of fields. So we expand frame view generator of a given type, but the type in this case was unpassed Ethernet frame as it was transmitted. Then a count, then any field syntax and any rest, and we expand to unpassed frame view generator, which will be shown next, with the field name, a type, and a count, and frame view generator, which is the macro itself. With the type, the count plus one, and the rest. So the termination of the recursion is the second macro rule. It's the frame view generator of a given name and a count, which is an expression, and nothing else. And then we define a method field count for a subclass of the given class, which just returns the count.
Actually, what we do hope here is that the plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one, that's the result of the expansion of that macro, is constant folded by the compiler to a constant. So that it actually can inline the field count method with a constant in the end. That's the kind of tricks we had to resort to since we don't have full procedural macros in Doom. But as you see, it's lambda complete. You can do arbitrary computations. It just might be ugly and expensive.
Okay, that's the last macro we want to show. It's the unpassed frame field generator. It's general. Well, that's the first half of the macro. It generates a getter. So unpassed frame field generator receives a name, a frame type, and a field index. That's the count we pass around. And it generates a defined inline method with the given name. So source address, destination address, which gets an object of the specified type, unpassed Ethernet frame in that case. And it returns an arbitrary object. So it first looks up in the unpassed frame, which has a slot cache and a slot for the byte vector. It looks if the frame is passed, so if it is contained in the cache object. If it is, it simply returns it. Else, it gets the frame field, which is a runtime meta information structure we came up with the given field index and the given frame. And sets the slot of the given name in the cache to the return value of past value. There's actually an error in this slide. It should be the set are not an equal, so a colon equal, double colon equal.
So this is also the source of non-performance at the moment in our framework, because the call to pass frame field is a generic function call, which involves necessary dispatch. So even though you could in theory know at compile time the precise offset and the precise type of the slot you're reading, and could all inline it down to one or two assembler calls, we can't do it at the moment because we have to basically generate the same code for all the slots, and we cannot do any analysis. And yeah.
Okay. Short summary of the given features we have in our domain-specific language. On the one hand, lazy parsing, so generate high-level object as lazy as we can. In-place reassembly, so once we have generated a byte vector from a high-level type, we can edit this byte vector and send it out multiple times without having to call assembly frame over and over. Then protocol features we have implemented. On the one hand, dynamic and static field offsets we can annotate in our domain-specific language. Frame translation, that's the 2-byte big endian unsigned integer to an integer. Protocol stacking, that's what we have not shown yet. You can annotate the Ethernet frame with a specific layering field, which is used for protocol stacking, and then annotate in an IPv4 frame how or this, what magic value it is spoken over Ethernet. Repeated fields are like IP options in an IP frame. They can be there multiple times, they can be there no times, and there are actually two cases. They can be externally delimited or internally delimited. It's the same with in DNS frames, you have name server records and so on, which are also repeated fields. Then default values is like the IP version in an IPv4 frame. It's by default for fixer functions, yeah, the same. You can have the length and header length in an IPv4 frame specified in our domain-specific language. And protocol inheritance, which is also used for IP options. That's described in the paper. The further development is, on the one hand, offset computation at compile time, so we want to generate getters and setters which know at which offset in the byte vector they have to access. So it's possible in the simple protocol definition. So once you know every length of the preceding fields, you can generate high-performance getter and setters, and you don't have to look up if you don't have to call that generic function getFrameField and passFrameField. Yeah, inlining of getter functions, that's the same basically, and reassembly of variably sized fields. Currently, our algorithm only works if the given field is of the same size.
So actually, to do that, we do need procedural macros. Fortunately, the people at Harlequin, which you might know from the Lispworks compiler, who wrote the Harlequin Dylan compiler, they also wanted to have procedural macros for their own compiler implementation. And they are in the compiler core. And they're implemented by bootstrapping, so by making sure that you have something that you can call at compile time and at runtime, because compile time and runtime is the same in the compiler. And we plan to extend that to have it available in user land to implement all the fun stuff that we want to have.
Yeah, that's the tool we implemented using our DSL and using a couple of hundred lines of DVIM code. DVIM was developed by Scott McKay, who is a preceder of CLIMP, or is the next design iteration of CLIM. Again, we can start the capturing of packets on my Ethernet interface. Then I can do something like ping the laptop there. And can look here at the ICMP frames, or first at the ARP frames, ARP who has ARP response, can look at the Ethernet frame. As I said, it has a destination address, a source address, and a dot code of 806. And yeah, well, the payload is an ARP frame. Yeah, the same with ICMP frames. Yeah, it's much like Wireshark or Etherreel. But we have also advanced features. We can do a telnet. So now we see here TCP frames. Now I can right click and kill this connection. Now I see here two reset frames are generated. And the connection is dead. So that's a basic proof of concept that we can do other things than Wireshark, because we can generate frames and send them out again. And it's about 100 lines of code, or I don't know, maybe 500 lines of full stuff. Yeah, I think that's all.
So much for the presentation.
Few questions.
Are you aware of Melange? It's an NPL metapacket language. It's a project which was called in the old matter of any here at Computer Lab. He has a domain specific language for describing packets which compiles into OCaml code. You can read about it in Eurosys this year.
No, there are some things we are aware of that do the same thing as we do. For instance, there was a macro in Genera, the list machine operating system, that pretty much does something like that for disk access. And then there's Scapy, which is written in Python, and which also does a lot of things we do. It does more interesting things with network packets, but it's using hash table lookups all over, so it will never be fast. Then there was something in Simon's book, and probably a couple we forgot, so we're not the first ones to do it.
So one of the interesting things is that he's put a lot of effort into making sure that it doesn't copy if it doesn't have to, and so he gets performance and jitter, which are equal or superior to C.
Okay.
So he's implemented an SSH server which actually can has better performance than OpenSSH.
That's interesting. So that's something we didn't mention. We basically do zero copy as well. We have a data structure that just keeps a pointer to your byte vector and bounds. And yeah, we also have an almost running TCP IP stack that's able to open up a TCP connection. It doesn't do retransmissions yet. But it's also basically zero copy. So we end up with data without copying. But it would be zero copy if we could get at the data from the kernel without copying, but we have to get rid of the Linux first.
So compiler macros for Dylan sounds like it's the obvious solution here. It's a universal mechanism that you need. And actually, it's not that bad a place to put it, is it? Because you did say the place where you need this general computation is in the type propagation, so you could have a rather complex macro that hopefully the compiler would cooperate with so that you could trace type propagation.
Exactly, yes. And that's basically, if you want to continue with that, if you want to reach all design goals, so we have a pretty compact description of the packets. We can describe all the formats we want, but the efficiency is lacking. It's the procedural macros we need to get there. And so it's either add that to the compiler or choose a different implementation language.
I have a two-part question. The first is just a practical question as far as
address, or does it only work if you're on the...
Well, it obviously only works if you can insert the packet into the connection and the other side sees it. So it, it actually goes there and sends the packet to the right router, but you have to be on the physical layer, of course.
And then I noticed that you said the getter methods with the lazy parsing, the efficiency that you're talking about trying to achieve. Right now, if I access any one of those fields, does it parse the whole packet and then give me the field that I want, or does it have some intelligence now to access to only access the things that it needs to determine where that?
It has some intelligence that is the get frame field that is hidden in the get frame field. So the frame field has the information at initialization time currently, whether it has a static offset or a dynamic offset. So if you want to pass the payload of an IPv4 frame, you have a dynamic offset. So you first have to pass the header length field, which has a static offset, then use this value and multiply it by 4, because it's in 32-bit size, and then access the payload at the given start offset. So we have intelligence there. We don't pass the whole packet. That's only the worst case. Every field preceding that field has a dynamic size.
All right, well, thank you very much once again.